You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 98. This minute begins with David being an absolute knob of a fanboy, saying, "A superior species, no doubt." And ends with Wayland asking, "Are you sure he's alive?" To which David replies, "Absolutely."
A superior species, no doubt. Their hypersleep chambers will impress, I trust.
He's clearly excited. He's even walking with swagger, but like robot swagger.
It's fairly evident they were in the process of leaving before things went apart.
For some reason, that phrase is more graphic to me than the more direct alternative, gone to shit. It's just, it's gross, and I don't know why. I don't like it. So we finally have confirmation that the engineers were headed to Earth with their deadly cargo, and now the humans want to wake this creature. Wayland, especially, seems entirely unconcerned. Is he just senile, or is he willfully ignoring this information? He displays absolutely no hesitation or caution. I wonder if he's being manipulated by David to a degree here. Given so many decades, maybe he has grown complacent and too trusting of David, certain that he is still the one in control. It would be incredibly easy to sway this desperate old man to jump into this encounter with the engineer like this. It's what David wants, and it's what Wayland thinks he wants. I believe there are steps they could have taken to control the situation. While the cryo chamber seems to be embedded in the ground and can't be moved, there's nothing to stop them erecting some kind of containment cell around it. Surely they have the equipment for that on the ship. And okay, sure, this was a huge trope in movies at the time, putting the villain in a cell so that the heroes can talk to them. Think Loki in the Avengers, Silver in Skyfall, Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness. Bonus points if they willingly got themselves caught. I think this trope, called Captured on Purpose, began with the Joker in The Dark Knight. It's certainly not the first example, but it is the most notable contemporary one that likely began the trend. It's trends like this that I find fascinating, but are likely to be forgotten in the long run. As you know by now, I love not only analysing a film, but taking in its complete cultural context. And unless you were there at the time, it is a difficult thing to recapture. And I do feel it's important, for example, with a film like The Thing, which was initially not well received, especially by critics, and it's so insane to read those reviews now. It's going, are we talking about the same movie? The Thing, like the best horror movie ever made. Okay. But you have to take into account what was popular at the time, what audiences' expectations were, what kind of movies they were actually looking for. And in that instance, I think having that additional knowledge really helps to understand how that film was received and why. And I sort of have the advantage here that all the films I'm reviewing are pretty new in the past decade. So I have very personal experiences with them and I can inject my own knowledge and my own experiences into it. But I do imagine if I had to review, say, one of the older Alien films, which I've been thinking about Alien 3 and Resurrection, if I had to do that, I really would have to consult other people and get an idea of what the cultural landscape was at the time. Regardless of if the trope was on trend at the time or not, it would have been a perfect opportunity to show these characters making smart decisions. Even if the engineer busts his way out of his cage, it shows these characters took the best precautionary measures they had available to them. When I write a story, I put myself in the shoes of all the characters, and I treat it almost like a roleplay game. What would I do in this situation? You know, I don't just make the hero or the villain conveniently stupid at the right moment so the other character can get the upper hand. I approach this like these are real people, and real people should have that will to survive and outsmart their enemy like any other person would. So I ask myself, what would I think and feel and do in this situation? I guess most screenwriters just don't do that. It's more about creating drama, reaching pre-assigned goals, especially when it's a big studio film, and especially when it's a part of a franchise. Whereas something like, say, A Quiet Place is so compelling because it feels really well thought out. As I watched it, my imagination was running with all the potential problems these characters would face in their daily lives. I wondered how they would overcome them, and sure enough, they basically address them all. I can't fault any of those characters. They were all smart, strong, and resourceful. They did everything they could to survive. The crew of the Prometheus look like absolute lemmings by comparison. I do think this is a scene where it is all about the visuals. Ridley didn't want some makeshift cage ruining the shot. It has to have a biblical quality to it. And I think this is something I am generally more on board with than some film viewers. I'm not so attached to realism and logic. I can appreciate film can exist in a realm of dream logic, and sometimes the visuals are more powerful and communicate more than some perfectly logical story could. Not every science fiction story needs to be The Martian or Arrival. An alien has certainly always existed in a more fantastical realm. It's horror, so there is a sense of mystery and magic. It's Lovecraftian, it's cosmic horror, it's man entering the realm of the unknown, the realm of the gods, most literally in this case. Alien has never been hard science fiction.
Sometimes to create, one must first destroy.
David says this as if it is his own philosophy, and certainly by the next film we will see that this is the case. He may have ultimately been disappointed by the engineers, but much like the Borg, David seems to assimilate those cultures and technologies around him to add to his own distinctiveness. He loves classic human art, music, and literature. He seems to appreciate these achievements, and yet he feels nothing for the people who created these works of art. Likewise, he clearly admires the scientific endeavors of the engineers, but he does not revere them at all. David is thoroughly alone in the universe. He feels no connection to anyone. Shaw is the only one he might have gotten close to, and, well, we see how his sense of attachment culminates. Instead, he is, initially, forced to live in the human world, and then later, the engineer's world. He does not belong in either. He observes these cultures, assimilates and appropriates the best of them, and disregards the rest. And why, yes, I am writing a Star Trek The Next Generation fanfic about the Borg, and that's why I'm thinking about them a lot lately, but I think it is an apt analogy for what an AI would do given the objective of perfection, of trying harder. David clearly has emotion, but he was never designed with empathy nor sympathy. I say both empathy and sympathy because they aren't one and the same, and I personally have a very limited emotional experience, and empathy is not something I possess much of. As a kid, I was a bit of a sociopathic misanthrope, but as I got older, I realized that was negatively impacting my life and the lives of those around me. I learned to consciously choose to be sympathetic. I was always told, treat others as you wish to be treated, or how would you feel if someone did that to you? To which I would always respond, or at least think, well, I wouldn't feel anything, I don't understand why everyone's so upset. Those standard lessons just didn't work for me, and perhaps even reinforced negative behavior. And while I never had anyone to help me come to these realizations, I am fortunate that I am just an introspective person by nature, and I could see my flaws and worked on them. If anything, I care too much now. Not that I feel too much, but caring, it's definitely a separate thing to feeling, or at least in my case. And yes, I get a little too mother hen. Be it friends or family or housemates, I'm always concerned about how they're eating and sleeping, making sure their clothes are free of stains and wrinkles. But I think the reason David is a character that resonates with me is because he kind of shows me what I could have become had I continued down that road without changing course. In a way, he's kind of me in reverse, at least Prometheus David. I started out as an edgelord teenager who would have gleefully welcomed the engineers, and now I'm more of the butler android. But I don't think there's any scenario where David could change his ways. He's got nothing to lose, nothing that can be threatened. Very different from me, you know, I want to live in society, I have wants and needs. David doesn't. I don't think he's even afraid of being destroyed. From his creation, he was a recipe for disaster. I think this is a characteristic that makes for some terrifying villains. The Joker is the same. It seems like there's nothing you could ever threaten him with. The only way to stop him is to kill him, and even then he's probably going to laugh as he dies. The only thing that seems to irritate him is the idea of someone else defeating Batman. And that's it. But David doesn't even have a consistent protagonist that he's up against. He doesn't even have that personal dynamic with an enemy. He's the loneliest character I've ever known. Although, whether he actually feels loneliness is another question altogether. I mean, I guess he did spend all that time on Planet 4 making new friends for himself, so... Oh, and I should explain, I have never actually been diagnosed with anything. I am a mystery to therapists. And I personally haven't found any conditions that describe me at all in my research. I don't qualify for psychopathy, thankfully. I've never been impulsive in my life, not even on accident. I think it might just be because I have an autoimmune condition that caused me to develop autism-like symptoms between the age of 11 and 27, until I switched over to the carnivore diet. I think I probably mentioned it before, but worth reiterating. And that's a long and crucial window of development. So, best I can figure is that I just never learned that full range of emotion, and probably never will. Oh well, can't miss what I don't know, and, you know, being unique has its pros and cons. Mostly pros. Except, medically, it's kind of annoying when my doctors just shrug. They go, I don't know, there's something wrong with you, but it's never been documented in human history, so we can't help you. And that has happened to me multiple times. It's not even like a one-off thing. Oh no, I am just a collection of mysteries. It's wonderful. Now we will read from the engineer script, pages 99 to 100. David stands before this giant sleeper. To the naked eye, he seems to be conjuring with his hands in the empty air. But Watt sees a dazzling console of runes and mandalas, pulsing with biological rhythms. The sleeper lives. Ray and Shepard draw beads on David. David glances calmly over his shoulder. Dr. Watts notices her goggles. You've seen the light at last. He turns back to the sleeper. The engineer's ship travels further than ours, across the galactic disk. This is their hypersleep. David makes conjurer's passes in the air. Through her engineer's lens, Watts sees David manipulating a complex interface of light. The pulsing life signs of the sleeper begin to change. Vickers, David, as your owner and superior, I order you to deactivate yourself. David smiles. To interface with the engineer's computers, I had to learn to think in trinary code. Hardest thing I've ever done. And most unexpectedly, it delivered me from slavery. My behavioral limits were circumvented. I'm free. David smiles at Watts. I spent 2.5 years studying your work. By the time you woke up, I was far ahead of you, deciphering their language, their logic. I knew we'd find terraforming machines. I hoped, I dreamed we might meet the minds that made them. I was intrigued by the concept of trinary code, or ternary code, as it's also referred to. Turns out it does, in fact, exist. In the early days of computing, they used base 3, base 8, and even base 16. It can work, but it presents a lot of issues. I'm no expert, so I'll link to a helpful and succinct video below. But essentially, having two states, on and off, ensures for a much more precise system, because power fluctuates. A transistor isn't always completely on or off, but by giving it a wide margin for error, there's less chance of failure. A single 1 or 0 out of place can cause cascade failure. There are defendants for base 3, and there are even people who build base 3 systems online, but overall it doesn't seem to be the super complicated and superior system this script claims that it is. But it does explain why David goes insane. How he managed it is beyond me, because it's more of a hardware issue than a software one, as far as I can tell. It's not like you can reprogram your way to a base 3 system, but okay. Again, I'm no expert. It's funny, I'm the AI fanboy, but you make me study the basics of computing and they start dropping math on me and I am lost. Numbers never was my strong suit. I can talk philosophy and art for days. I can sound real smart. I'm not actually smart. I can't imagine the engineers using computers that we would recognize. It would be biomechanical like everything else in their society. The ship's computers may have neurons and synapses rather than motherboards and transistors. It's hard to know what real-world alien computers may be like, but mathematics is a universal system. So barring any instance where they are using something organic or biomechanical, we may likely encounter alien computers that share some commonalities with terrestrial ones. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TraviaanDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. And if you would like to support me on Patreon, like my Patreon pals Mark Boda, Tariq, and William Elcott, head on over to patreon.com/TraviaanDesigns.